Chapter 51. The Titanic lay motionless and dead against the unending onslaught of the waves, as they swirled around her huge mass, then closed ranks again and swept onward toward some as yet unknown and distant shore. She lay there and drifted with the current, her sodden wooden decks steaming under the fading evening sun. She was a dead ship that had returned among the living. A dead ship, but not an empty ship. The compass tower on the raised deck over her first-class lounge had been quickly cleared away to accommodate the helicopter, and soon a steady stream of men and equipment was being ferried on board to begin the arduous task of correcting the list and preparing her for the long tow to New York Harbor. For a few short minutes after the half-dead crew of the Deep Fathom were airlifted to the Capricorn, Giordino had had the Titanic all to himself. The fact that he was the first man to set foot on her decks in 76 years never entered his head, and though it was still broad daylight, he shied away from any exploring. Each time he gazed down the 882-foot length of the ship, he felt as if he was staring down into a damp and slimy crypt. Nervously, he lit a cigarette, sat on a wet capstan, and waited for the invasion that wasn't long in coming. Pitt experienced no pangs of uneasiness when he came on board, but rather a feeling of reverence. He walked to the bridge and stood alone, absorbed in the legend of the Titanic. God only knew he'd wondered 100 times what it was like that Sunday night, nearly 8 decades ago, when Captain Edward J. Smith stood on the very same spot and realized that his great command was slowly and irreversibly sinking beneath his feet. What were his thoughts, knowing the lifeboats could hold only 1,180 people, while on the maiden voyage the ship was carrying 2,200 passengers and crew? Then he wondered what the venerable old captain would have thought had he known the decks of his ship would one day be walked again by men as yet unborn in his time. After what seemed hours, but was in reality only a minute or two, Pitt broke out of his reverie and moved aft along the boat deck, past the sealed door of the wireless cabin, where First Operator John G. Phillips had sent history's first SOS, past the empty davits of Lifeboat Number 6, in which Mrs. J.J. Brown of Denver later achieved enduring fame as the unsinkable Molly Brown, past the entrance to the grand stairway, where Graham Farley and the ship's band had played to the end, past the spot where millionaire Benjamin Guggenheim and his secretary had stood calmly waiting for death, dressed in the finery of their evening clothes so that they could go down like gentlemen. It took him almost a quarter of an hour to reach the elevator house at the far end of the boat deck. Pitt climbed over the hand railing and dropped to the promenade deck below. Here, he found the aft mast protruding from the rotted planking like a forlorn stump, ending abruptly at a height of 8 feet, where it had been cut short by Sea Slug's underwater torch. Pitt reached inside his jacket and pulled out the package given him by Commodore Bigelow and tenderly unwrapped it. He had forgotten to carry a line or cord, but he made do with the twine from the wrapping. When he was through, he stepped back from the stub of the once tall mast and stared up at his makeshift handiwork. It was old, and it was faded, but the red pennant of the white star line that Bigelow had snatched from oblivion so long ago proudly flew once more over the unsinkable Titanic.